Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. As we approach the 10th anniversary of 9/11, we're taking some time this week to discuss how we've changed and how the attacks impacted our lives, communities, cities, and country. On today's show, we'll get started with three uniquely different perspectives. Moeen Khawaja, Executive Director of Philadelphia's chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, will discuss how the attacks and their aftermath were experienced by Muslim Americans. Later, we'll hear from Philadelphia Inquirer architectural columnist Inga Safran and discuss the myriad ways in which the threat of terrorism has changed our cities and public spaces. But first, our guest is Daryl Bakke. He is a volunteer firefighter with Bridgeport Fire Company No. 1 and also the King of Prussia Volunteer Fire Company and an honorary member of Brooklyn Squad 252, which lost several members in the collapse of the Twin Towers. Bakke spent 9 months working on the pile, the smoldering rubble that remained at the World Trade Center, and is working to build a memorial with his friends and colleagues in his King of Prussia firehouse. Daryl, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Daryl, let's take a look back. Where were you on September 11th, 2001?
Working at my full-time job. I'm a licensed funeral director. And I was at a church, and I had a friend of mine called me, David Gallagher. He's a firefighter in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, saying a plane hit the Trade Center. And like everyone, we thought it was just a Piper Cub. It was an accident. And, we all know now that as the day unfolded, it was not that.
And as a volunteer firefighter, did you then have any immediate duties?
Well, not here in the King of Prussia area, but my main concern was for my friends at Squad 252 in Brooklyn, New York, their safety, because I knew their job would be to be assigned to that box to go to the World Trade Center.
And when and how did you decide that you wanted to go to New York?
Well, what I did is I kept calling the firehouse in Brooklyn all day long and all night long, and finally got through around 11 o'clock at night, and I spoke to Mr. Lyons. His son was killed at the Trade Center, Patty Lyons. I called him, and he said he's waiting for the guys to come back. Now, this was 11 o'clock at night, and I knew they weren't coming back. In my heart of hearts, I knew they weren't coming back. So the following day, I called the firehouse again, and I got a hold of the captain at the time, Chief Rossweiler. Now he's retired. And I said, Chief, I want to come up. He said, look, Daryl, you can't get into the city. Stay there. Come up on Friday and give us a hand. So I went Friday. I stayed at the firehouse and cleaned at the firehouse. And then Saturday, Sunday, I was actually at the Trade Center.
And how did you know these guys in New York?
Well, my dream as a young boy is I wanted to be a New York City fireman. But when I eventually made up my mind to take the test, I was too old by 6 months. Right. They got me on my background check and said, Mr. Bakke, you're too old. So what I did is became friendly with different people up there and friends with the people that took the test. And a friend of mine is now a fire marshal in the city. He was at Squad 252, Woody McHale, Mark McHale. He said, come to my firehouse in Brooklyn and you just be an honor, be a buff, they call it, and just come to the firehouse. And he knew me. You know, I knew it wouldn't get anybody's way. And what I did is I went to the firehouse, and I've been there 19 years now. I went to the firehouse, and it was an engine 252 at the time, and he said, come on up. So I went up and met the captain. The captain goes, you can come here anytime you want to. And I've been there ever since.
And why did you want to be a New York City fireman? Was there something special about them long before 9/11?
Well, yeah, I wanted to be that. I always wanted to be a fireman. I'm still doing it at age 53 years old. I just like the excitement of it. And why New York City? Everybody says that because it's the busiest in the world, and the chances of promotion. You know, I didn't want to ride on the back of a fire truck all my life. Promotion to lieutenant, to captain, to battalion chief, to deputy chief. Your opportunities are so much more than, say, the city of Philadelphia. They only have about 2,500 members. New York City Fire Department has 11,500 members.
So when you got to New York in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, when did you start actually working at the World Trade Center site?
Okay, well, I got there on Friday, and nobody was at the firehouse, and I just cleaned all day at Friday. I cleaned their boots. I mean, from them walking around at the pile, you can smell the decomposing body flesh on the boots. So I cleaned their jackets, their boots, cleaned the firehouse. It was overwhelmed with mice because people were dropping off food and things like that. And then actually Saturday and Sunday, I worked at the Trade Center, went with the guys, and we crossed over to Brooklyn Bridge in the fire truck and got to the site, and it was just unbelievable. I mean, you know, the North and South Towers, 15, 20 stories of rubble. Cars were still exploding as they're moving them around to dig and look for people. They were still exploding. There were still fires. The odor from the decomposing bodies was overwhelming. It's just unbelievable. It's something I hope I never see in my lifetime again.
And can you describe, of those who came back to the firehouse, can you describe just a bit of what the mood was, what the tone was? There were so many guys who had not come back.
Well, you know, at 2:52, there was the six firefighters plus one of the firefighters there, John Feehan. His father was the first deputy fire commissioner. He was killed too. So, really, seven from the firehouse. The mood was, in the beginning, hopefully they're going to find him alive in the first day or two. But, you know, that never came to fruition. Now it was recovery. Their mood was to find their remains and have a proper burial for them. And that didn't happen. There was only three out of the seven that were found. And the mood was every day, let's just see if we can find them. Let's see if they can find them to give them some finalization for their families. And, you know, somewhere to go when they're buried to pay respect for them. But obviously that didn't happen.
And you were, in your other job, you are a funeral director.
Right,
A bit about the role of the body. Just having that for a family, what does it mean?
Well, you need that. I have a funeral home and a crematory. You need that to, in your mind, to say, yes, that person is definitely had passed away. And some of these families today are still, you know, they know, but in the back of their mind, they wish they would have had the remains of their loved ones to say goodbye, and they didn't have that. I was fortunate enough. I've been in the funeral business since I was 14 years old. I knew what a body decomposed body smells like. I know what cremated remains look like. I was very fortunate, and they allowed me to be there because after the first couple weeks, nobody was allowed there. It was New York City Fire Department, Police Department, ESU, and those invited. I was fortunate enough that my friend was a battalion chief at the time, Chief Rasweller. He talked to the big bosses, and he said, look, I got this guy from Pennsylvania. He's been in my firehouse now for a long time. He's a funeral director. He owns a crematory. He knows what to look for. And one day, one of the top brass was there when I found a gentleman's head. It was a skull. There was nothing there. And the guys were stepping on it. They didn't know what it was, and I knew what it was. And everybody's on their knees, and like, how do you know, Darryl? And when I picked up the skull, and I said, look, this is where the teeth are. This is the mandible. And their eyes are like, whoa. And then, you know, just I was fortunate enough. I like I said, that I'm in this business. I knew what to look for. I knew what cremated bones were looking like. I knew all that stuff, you know. And it was just, to me, I looked at it this way, that I could help anybody, whether it was a firefighter or a civilian, have some finalization, that they got something back, whether it was a little piece of bone or their whole body.
We're talking with Darryl Bakke. He's a volunteer firefighter and also a funeral director, and he worked in New York City on the side of the World Trade Center for months after the attacks. And Darryl, why did you want to stay? Obviously, you wanted to help. You wanted to do something. But why did you continue to do this?
Well, I just felt inside of me it was something I had to do. I saw the pain on my friend's face that survived the Trade Center. I saw their pain, and it was something I had to do. And I did it as much as possible without interfering with my full-time job down here, because obviously when somebody dies down here, I have to service those families too. But I would go there as much as I can. Sometimes I just go on my own. I wouldn't even go to the firehouse. I would just say, look, Cap, I'm going to the Trade Center. And say, go ahead, Darryl, no problem. I had an ID card.
And what kind of work did you do? Describe a bit of the physical work. Did you remove rubble, sift through the rubble? What was your daily duties like when you were there?
Well, I wasn't really in a bucket brigade, because the squad company was more search and rescue. But what I did is I just observed with the rest of the guys. We stood there as the big grapplers would pull things apart and set it to the side. We would sit there and observe. Did we see any type of a body? Did we see anything that was recognizable from a body? Did we see fire department gear? One particular night, it was about 3:30 in the morning. The place is well lit, and I'm standing at the top of what was left of the pile. My friend Richie Sweeney was about 20 feet away from me, 25, 30 feet away from me. And we had these masks, but in order to smell anything, you had to take the mask off. So it was like a catch-22. You're going to breathe the dust, or you're going to smell, you know, the bodies. And the grappler was working, and I could smell the decomposing body. Richie didn't know what that odor was. It was an ammonia smell. So I whistled to him, and he went, we pointed down, and there was a body. The grappler had actually had pulled the body in half, pulled it apart. And we went down, and we found the upper part of the torso and the lower part of the torso, and we went through his pockets, and we found his wallet. And I purposely didn't look at his name because I didn't want to remember the guy. But he had a one-day pass at a trade center, poor soul.
Mm. Yeah. And now, 10 years later, when you think about it, it seems like those memories are right there on top of your head.
Absolutely.
So
it's like it happened yesterday.
Is it strange that it's been 10 years?
Yes. It's overwhelming that it's 10 years and the pain is still there. I will be going up Saturday to set up for the remembrance, the 10-year remembrance at the firehouse. And all that pain, you can hear it in my voice a little bit, it's all coming back. And it's going to be a really, really tough Friday and Saturday and really, really tough on Sunday to revisit this, because now the families that we see once a year, those families are going to be there, and the pain for them is just like it happened yesterday.
Talk a bit about the sense of connectedness with your fellow firefighters, be it here or there, that all of this created.
Well, we now have a special bond, band of brothers. There's been some things, there's been movies and stuff like that, but we have a special bond. We were together at something was so horrific. It's just like the guys from Pearl Harbor, during World War II. We will always have that special bond. When we see each other, we hug each other, we tell each other we love each other. It's just unbelievable, the camaraderie we have now.
Was it hard as the country began to move on and to move away from what had happened? Was that difficult because you were still there and going there, and it seems like your mind is still there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I belong to a civic organization here, and this is about 3 or 4 months into it, and the country was starting to move on. It was like in the back of their head. It was still there, but it was in the back of their head. And I had one of these gentlemen said to me, "I don't know what the big deal is. Let's get this cleaned up and let's move on with our lives." And I just sat there and I said, "How can you say that? If it was your brother or your mother, your father, your sister, daughter laying at the bottom of that pile and a machine just picked you up and threw you in a dumpster and took you to Staten Island, the Fresh Kills landfill, and sorted you out, how would you feel?" And he just put his head down and he didn't say another word to me.
And Daryl, we're going to have to wrap up in a few seconds, but what are some things you want to do to keep the memory alive?
Well, I just hope we never forget. I hope that, in the future, they put it in the history books that we were attacked, and then these innocent people going to work, and my friends, firefighters, and the ESU cops, and everybody else, were murdered by these terrorists. And just hopefully, it's never turned around. It was something we did to provoke this. We didn't. We were just going to work that day.
Daryl Bakke, thank you so much. He is a funeral director and a volunteer firefighter and worked in New York to clean up the World Trade Center site. Thank you so much for being with us. Coming up, we'll talk about how Muslim Americans experienced 9/11 and the aftermath. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Drexel University supports WHYY. If you are at least 20 pounds overweight, you may be eligible to participate in a research study called Project Well at Drexel University. This year-long weight loss study is sponsored by the National Institutes of Health and is designed to help adult participants lose weight and keep it off without medication. Guidance from weight loss specialists at group meetings is included. For more information, 215-762-1111, 215-762-1111.
Right after 9/11, Americans united in righteous anger and resolve. As we returned to daily life, our world was transformed.
There was a younger generation whose first sense of their civic identity was formed around the crisis of 9/11.
For more stories and an invitation to share your experiences, go to whyy.org/After 9/11.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing, storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM. or listen online at whyy.org and newsworks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow Newsworks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain. This week, we're taking time to remember 9/11 and to discuss how the country has changed over the past decade. Joining us now is Moeen Khawaja. He is the executive director of the Philadelphia chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Moeen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Mike, and appreciate it.
And Moeen, where were you on September 11th, 2001?
No, I was actually in college, and we had just, since it was September, we were only within a week of school. I still remember it, you know, very vividly. My mom had called me about 8 in the morning. She said, "You've got to turn the TV on," and that's all she said. My mom's not someone, I mean, she's never said that. You know, she's not someone to tell me to turn the TV on or even watch the news. So I knew right when she said that, with her voice shaking, that something was happening. I turned it on, and you know, I got all my roommates to start watching the TV. And I remember their reactions and most of my Muslim friends. And it went something like, you know, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe this is happening. Someone is really, really attacking America." And then, of course, a few of us had family and friends in New York. We were all trying to make phone calls. As you know, the phones didn't really work. So we all just skipped class and watched TV. But then came the second thought. After a few hours, when the second plane hit and it was clear that it was a terrorist attack, it was, "Please, please don't let it be Muslims. Because if it is, this changes everything." And sure enough, it did.
Hmm. And how old were you at the time?
I was actually a freshman in college, so I was 18 years old.
And where had you grown? Where did you grow up?
I went to college at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and I grew up all my life in Springfield, Illinois, and Chicago was always like a second home to me as well. So I've only been out in the East Coast for about 3 years now.
And you said, "Please don't let it be Muslims."
Mm-hmm.
When did you find out that it had been an extreme group?
Well, as soon as the second plane hit, they started, you know, speculating that it was Al-Qaeda, and then we saw pictures of Osama bin Laden flash across the screen, and the taglines underneath and the captions underneath each picture said Muslim extremist or Islamic terrorist. And it wasn't just terrorists, it wasn't just Al-Qaeda, it was always prefaced with Islam or Muslims. And I thought, okay, this is something that's going to be pinned on the entire faith. You know, it's always been a double hit for Muslims in America, 9/11. The first hit, our country was attacked. You know, we donated blood. Many Muslim first responders went to the scene. It's our country, and we were attacked. But then, you know, to this day, I feel like Al-Qaeda attacked me twice. Once by murdering so many fellow citizens, but the second time by smearing my faith, by smearing the very thing that causes me to do good, to treat my parents right, to give charity, and to be a good citizen, by making that beautiful thing to me into a very nasty and ugly and tarnished thing. And I will never forgive Al-Qaeda for that. Never.
And at the time you were on a college campus, did people start to treat you differently? Was there any immediate backlash?
No. In fact, we had we had some very, very great experiences that really, you know, I still recall these experiences, and they really caused me to believe in America and never lose hold of that belief. For example, we had a mosque on campus, and a lot of churches, we had great relationships with churches nearby, and a lot of them had called the police and said, you need to go guard the mosque, make sure nothing happens to it. People left flowers, it was clear that it was an attack by a foreign group, and the Muslim community in America wasn't a suspect domestically. I'm very sad to say that that's not the case entirely now, 10 years later. But right after, you know, the days and the weeks following, you know, we were Americans just like everyone else, and that's it.
And did you see a lot of things on television and in the subsequent media coverage that was inaccurate or made you mad? I think sometimes when everybody starts trying to talk about something they don't really know a whole lot about, you start hearing all kinds of things. So was there a lot of misconceptions that you heard about your faith? That
certainly there were, but you know, I don't blame the media entirely. I don't blame Americans entirely. See, we weren't I mean Muslims in America, we didn't have the proper built-up infrastructure. We didn't do a lot of media work. We didn't go out and speak and talk about who we were. There were only a few national Muslim organizations, and it doesn't help when Osama bin Laden himself and Al-Qaeda themselves described themselves as Muslims and performing a Muslim duty. I think if they were just, say, Afghanis, and they had a problem with America, and then it would be an attack from Afghanistan on America. But that's not how they spun it. They always said, we're doing this because it was we believe our religion told us to. And, you know, certainly they had foreign policy grievances, but they always mixed in religion with it. So it really, you know, we wanted to say, hold on, stop. They don't represent anyone. In fact, we don't even consider them to be Muslims. How could you be a Muslim and believe in this and do this? But it really didn't help when one of their main talking points was, you know, we're doing this because we think God told us to.
Were people asking you about your experience, your fellow students, your professors at school?
Yeah. I did get some phone calls, especially from concerned friends of mine who weren't Muslim, to make sure that everything was okay, that no one had hurt us or anything. Now, certainly there was a backlash. I remember, you know, we got some hate mail and things like that. And every now and then somebody
Who's
would shout on the street. They'd scream, hey, jihadi, go home or what have you. But I personally did not experience any physical or verbal attack, you know, anything that stirred me. Now, a lot of Muslims have, and, you know, that's something we still deal with here at CARE on a regular basis.
So talk a bit about your identity growing up, and maybe tell us a little bit about your family background. Are, you know, did you feel you were an American first, a Muslim second? How did you think of yourself before and after 9/11?
That's a great point. I was actually very lucky. I mean, as I said, I was 18 when it happened, so I had a pretty good sense of who I was in terms of identity. I had formed a healthy identity. I was always American. I was born and raised here. There's no other home for me. I don't know anything else to be my home. And, you know, my parents were immigrants from Pakistan. They came in the 70s. I was born in the 80s. But still, I was always, you know, I played sports. I was very active in high school, what have you. So I was always American by nationality. That was always my country, and I was a Muslim by faith. I just prayed to God like a Muslim. I never felt or still feel that these are mutually exclusive things by any stretch of the imagination. So I had a very secure, confident idea of who I was and where I was going. Now, we see now, through the work that I do with CARE, we see a lot of Muslim youth, you know, adolescents, 11, 12, 13-year-old kids who get bullied, who get called names, get called terrorists. They're very unsure of whether they truly belong here. They're also born and raised here. But growing up in this time, post 9/11, is very tough for teenagers who are forming their identities and trying to, you know, get a real sense of who they are. And so we're trying to do a lot of work to tell them, hey, look, you might be bullied, you might be called names, but this is your home. This is where your loyalties must lie, and I think we've done a good job. But then, of course, a few have slipped through the cracks. But personally, I'm very confident that I belong here. In fact, I do. I don't ever feel insecure about that, and I'm confident that Muslims in America will also develop that security, especially for those who don't have that just yet.
We're talking with Muin Khawaja. He's the executive director of the Philadelphia chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, and you call it, you say CARE, right?
Mm-hmm.
For short.
Yes, right.
So just if you've heard that, that's what we're referring to. And if you want to weigh in with your questions or comments, please give us a call at 1-888 1-888-477-9499. That's Radio Times here at 1-888-477-9499. And Muin, you seem to say that in the immediate aftermath of the terrorist attacks, things were not so bad. But now there were times when relations have deteriorated. So do you feel like we're worse off now than we were immediately after?
I wouldn't say worse off. Certainly, there was an immediate backlash in 2001, 2002, and then to 2003 when the Iraq War started. But then 05, 06, 07, things kind of got better for Muslims in America. And then we were very upset to see that there was a big uptick in backlash in 07, 08, and 09. And we think this correlates with a few things. It correlates with the economy, for sure. But in a strange way, it also correlates with the election of President Obama. See, when Bush was president, the very first time he addressed the nation, he said, "Look, we were not attacked by Islam. We were not at war with a religion." He always went out of his way to say Islam is a religion of peace. Muslims have been in America for hundreds of years, and they are our fellow citizens. When that voice of moderation left the conservative movement, that really opened the floodgates for a lot of right-wing commentators and anti-Muslim organizations to jump on and say, okay, now this is our chance to pump up the rhetoric. Because we found when responsible rhetoric comes from Republican leaders, it actually ends up being a very good thing for Muslims. Now, President Obama has certainly engaged in responsible rhetoric as well, but then the other side doesn't listen to him. In fact, the other side, a big portion of them think he's a Muslim. So that kind of created a situation where we have a lot of organizations devoted to saying, well, look, yes, we were attacked on 9/11, but Islam itself and Muslims themselves, including Muslims in America, have the potential to become terrorists just like anyone else. And that's the real twist we've seen over the last few years.
And I want to ask you how the issue of extremism comes up within your community and within your faith community. And do you talk about it differently when you're amongst yourself, so to speak, or when you're communicating a message? Is it a worry? How is it talked about?
No, we're... at the end of the day, Muslims still feel that homegrown radicals are such a small minority that for us to even come across one, I think since 9/11, there's been 150 American Muslims who have been arrested or have engaged in plots or have expressed the interest in engaging in plots. Of course, that's one too many, but out of a population of 6 million, it's really I can't name a lot of people who know someone directly who said extreme things or even supported terrorism in any way. However, it is a concern, as I said, with kids forming their identities, not knowing how to express dissatisfaction with foreign policy, not having proper outlets to express grievances. We're seeing them retreat away from mosques where they can be moderated, where they can speak to a mentor. We're seeing those kids go away and then form their own chat groups online. And that's really the core of the issue. A lot of radicalization has been occurring online, and that's very hard to monitor. It's very hard to police. It's very hard to see who's doing what in their basement. So the other thing is mosque leadership, it doesn't want to be associated with anybody who's extreme. So whenever someone expresses anything out of the ordinary, there is, restraining orders are served and they're asked to leave. So where there might be an opportunity to talk to someone, get them to calm down, those people are asked to leave.
So they are outcasts, so to speak.
Yeah.
And I spoke with another Arab American leader in this area who said he felt the community has been silenced on many levels, especially newer immigrants. And maybe their kids are bullied in school, or maybe they are being called names, but they are afraid to say anything because they fear retribution. Is that something you've experienced? Or yeah. you hear?
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, a lot of people have lost confidence. In fact, we hear story after story of, you know, Muslim women who had once previously worn the scarf, the headscarf. They've taken it off so that they fit in and don't have eyes drawn onto them. But at the same time, we've seen a lot of stories of empowerment. We've seen a lot of Muslim kids say, "Listen, I don't want to be a lawyer or a doctor or go to business school. I want to become a journalist. I want to go out there and create stories and write plays, and write novels and books because we have to talk about who we are." So we've seen a little bit of both. Some people have pulled back, especially those who've experienced, you know, a hate crime or vandalism or harassment at work. We've seen them sort of retreat, and then we've also seen a new group of people step up and say, "Listen, we can't just hide in the shadows. We have to say who we are, what we believe in, and how we plan to contribute to America." And I think that's a very healthy development.
Let's take a very quick call from Sarah. She's joining us from Yardley. Hi, Sarah. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to add to something that Mr. Moeen is saying, which is, and I'm sorry, when I was on hold, I couldn't hear the radio. So regarding, like, Muslim victims, I'm Muslim myself, and in the sense that I think they really had a double whammy, that if they had lost loved ones in the World Trade Center or in the other two situations, that the other two tragedies, that they were carrying this double burden of, particularly if they were visibly Muslim, that they were suffering as victims or families of victims, but, you know, perhaps being harassed or otherwise in public, being that they looked Muslim. And just a quick story, I wear hijab myself, the Muslim woman's headdress, and I was traveling to Florida several months later, and a young woman in front of me was reading, I guess it was about a year later, the People edition of babies that were born after 9/11 to fathers that had died there. And one of the women was wearing hijab, one of the 50 women that they cited. And I felt the woman was sitting right in front of me who was reading it, and I kind of just, you know, was watching her, and I saw her read each biography of the mothers, and as she got to her page, she just quickly turned it and went on to the next. And I felt sort of that insensitivity, sort of like as if her suffering was less, or her, I felt it was a little bit sad, you know, more so that maybe the same woman, when she went out, was getting more glares, getting more harassing comments, but she too was a victim, lost her husband. And I just think that's there also, and I think the Al-Qaeda mentality would kill American Muslims before they would kill non-Muslim Americans. They have more of a hatred for us because they consider us too moderate.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that call, Sarah. And Moeen, we only have about a minute left. So is that suspicion, that kind of, you know, what Sarah just described, being the other, is that still very much part of a lot of Arab Americans' lives?
Yes, unfortunately it is. I think if we could end on one note, I think a good microcosm of how Muslim Americans felt can be relayed through the story of Salman Hamdani, for example. He was a 23-year-old paramedic in New York City. He had rushed into the World Trade Center to help and unfortunately died when the towers collapsed. Now, the few days that he was missing,
I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt you, but we're coming up on a break, so I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we have
thank
to move
much.
On with Radio Times. And Moeen is the executive director of the Philadelphia chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations. We'll talk about how the threat of terrorism has changed the urban landscape next here on Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and recognizes Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Prostate cancer is second only to skin cancer among U.S. men. African American men and men with a family history of prostate cancer are at increased risk. Fox Chase's Prostate Cancer Risk Assessment Service helps you make informed decisions about risk and prevention. It all begins with a detailed analysis of your family medical history. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase, hearts plus minds.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter Dana Priest about her new book, Top Secret America. It exposes a hidden world created after 9/11, an unwieldy network without thorough oversight, comprised of thousands of government organizations and private companies related to programs on counterterrorism and homeland security. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Can the rebels in Libya complete their mission and take control of the remaining Gaddafi strongholds? Also, composers mark 9/11 from Steve Reich to John Adams. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowane. We've been talking about different ways in which 9/11 changed us, our communities, and our country. Joining us now is Philadelphia Inquirer architectural columnist Inga Safran, and she will discuss with us the changed landscape of our cities and public spaces. And Inga, right now you are at Harvard doing a fellowship, right?
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Yes, I'm in Boston right now.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Where were you 10 years ago? Where were you on September 11th, and what were you thinking about?
Well, I remember that morning with great clarity because I was writing my column. I was working at home because sometimes it's hard to work in the office, and I was writing a column. I can't remember what it was about, but a friend of mine called to say that a plane had crashed into one of the Twin Towers in New York. And when I got off the phone, I said, I'm not calling my office because, you know, it's an accident and, you know, I have to finish this column. And then I saw on the web that a second plane had crashed into a tower, and I knew immediately this was not an accident, that something very serious had happened.
And given what you do for a living, had you thought about the vulnerability of tall buildings? Had that ever crossed your mind?
Well, not so much. I mean, of course, in Philadelphia, we had one of the world's worst high-rise fires at the Meridian Tower across from City Hall, where the Ritz-Carlton now is. And so, you know, I knew, you know, high-rise skyscrapers could be destroyed. They weren't invincible. But I hadn't thought about it in that way.
Were you surprised when the towers fell?
Oh, as much as everyone else.
Yeah.
I had the same sense of disbelief and shock.
Yeah. And then talk a bit about just the changed skyline of New York City and how that enters our mind every time you get to New York or every time you see an old picture of New York.
Yeah, you know, those two towers, which were designed by Minoru Yamasaki, an American architect, were not really loved. You know, they were very stark, modernist towers, really gargantuan, overscaled, and at the ground, they were very unfriendly. They sat on a big platform that was very forbidding. You had to walk around the platform. But they had the effect of kind of anchoring Manhattan Island. They were the terminus, these two twin towers. And, you know, for many Philadelphians who would take the train or drive to New York, you know, as you neared the city, the crossings into the city, you would see these two towers. And they were, you know, a landmark. They told you where you were. Similarly, if you were in Manhattan, you know, you could always orient yourself. You knew which way was south because you would look down an avenue and you would see them. And so I do remember the first time I went to New York, which is only a couple days after the attack, and being on the train as it, you know, approached the tunnel to go to Manhattan, and seeing that vista of Manhattan and the towers weren't there. And it was so disorienting and upsetting.
Has the threat of terrorism changed the design and building of tall structures? I'm thinking of, for example, the Comcast building in Philadelphia. Were there any special considerations?
Oh, yeah. You know, one of the things we learned when those towers were hit was how difficult it was for people to exit. We learned a lot about exit stairs. We learned a lot about secure areas from fire, and lots of changes were made in designs. And in Europe, they had been building more in with concrete frames, which allowed for improvement in emergency exiting. And the new what used to be called Freedom Tower at Ground Zero, and is now called World Trade Center 1. That building is now being built in concrete instead of a steel frame, and it has three sets of exit stairs. One of those sets of exit stairs is just for the responders, and that was a direct result of what happened.
Now, let's talk a bit about how all cities started to change in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks. What were some of the first things we started to see here in Philadelphia? I remember Independence Mall changing, for example.
Well, of course, you know, no one knew what the next target would be.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know, everyone was on high alert trying to figure out what might be a terrorist target. And, you know, the way security works is better safe than sorry, and so we saw all sorts of public places put on high alert with these bicycle barricades and police and extra security and lots of public spaces we had been used to just wandering into were cordoned off. We, you know, even office buildings, ordinary office buildings that weren't connected with government, we now have to sign in. Show identification. Some of that has eased a bit. I mean, obviously, some of it was really excessive. People may recall when Chestnut Street, the main east-west thoroughfare in Philadelphia, was cut off in the middle in front of Independence Hall because people thought that the terrorists had put Independence Hall on their list of targets. So people went kind of insane.
We're talking with Inga Safran. She's the architectural columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And if you want to weigh in on security and how the threat of terrorism has changed our landscape, our urban landscape, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. Now, obviously, the first barriers that we saw go up have been replaced with more permanent structures. And something we see a lot are those big planters. Can you describe them a bit and how they work and, in your opinion, how they look?
Yeah, they're these like pillbox-shaped concrete barriers, and that's sort of the most basic form. And what you often see is a whole block ringed with these bollards, as they're called. You see it around City Hall. You see it around the new IRS building, which used to be the post office in Philadelphia. And they're very unfortunate because, although they're effective for, I guess, stopping, a truck bomb, they imprison the building. It's like a stockade fence around the building. And so a lot of architects have advocated more subtle versions of these bollards where you can mix it up with, concrete benches or planters. But the idea is that it should be designed. It shouldn't be ad hoc. And that it also can have, a more social purpose like benches and planters.
Are there people in the field who specialize in that aspect of the design process? And in a big firm, would they have somebody who does that kind of work specifically?
Well, of course, there are whole firms that are security consultants. And yeah, lots of architects. have people who are experts in that. The National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, for example, which was designed by Henry Cobb of Pay Cobb and Freed, you know, he was very adamant that that building, which had all the, you know, the symbolism of being a, you know, a story about the Constitution, should not look like it was imprisoned. And he made sure that the various bollards that protect it are more subtle.
And do you think he succeeded?
I do. I mean, I think there's a big difference if you look at the perimeter of that block, and then you look at the perimeter of the new IRS headquarters next to 30th Street Station. It's a huge difference because a ring of bollards, it really does look like a stockade fence. It really is off-putting.
And how does all of this security, these security measures, whether it be big planters, how do they affect how we walk, how we get around, and how we interact?
Well, I think this is one of the real tragedies of 9/11 is that we're more disconnected from our commonly held public places like Independence Hall. I used to love cutting through the square behind Independence Hall, going through those arcades. You know, I love the idea, you know, that this building that was one of our earliest public places was still accessible to me, you know, in the 21st century. I can't do that anymore. You know, that's lost to us. And that connection to our past, to our origins, in so many places is lost. Just wandering into City Hall, you can't do that anymore. There's this wonderful octagonal staircase in City Hall, and I used to just love walking up it to go interview someone or go to a meeting, and you know, now you got to go through one doorway, go through security. It's pretty painful.
Mm. What makes us, in terms of the design of a space, what makes us feel safe as opposed to intimidated by a structure? You know, what are the kinds of spaces that we feel safe and welcome in, and when does a space start to make us feel small or intimidated?
Well, I you know, I guess in this case, you know, if there's kind of a mouse run, you know, where you have to run this gauntlet, you know, that creates a, you know, a feeling of being watched. If there's a lot of visible security, you know, that can be unnerving. You know, people with guns, that's all unnerving. You know, and, you know, seeing a lot of layers of heavy-duty protection, concrete, you know, it's not welcoming. You're immediately on alert when you approach those kinds of visible signs of security. Now, some people would argue, I think, that they feel safer when they know everything's, you know, under watch. And, you know, I've heard this argument made about airports that some people like the intense security at airports because they feel safer getting on a plane. And I think there is something to that argument. But it's a balance.
And you mentioned earlier that with a lot of tall structures, people are starting to use more concrete. Will that make a building just by nature look more just blocky, and it will lose some of the lightness that?
I don't think that has to happen at all, you know, because it's going to be covered with some material, like Tower 1 will be completely covered in glass. So you won't know, or most people won't know, that the first 200 feet of Tower 1 is a concrete bunker, six foot thick concrete. I mean, you may, because the glass will camouflage it. No, I don't think that the concrete buildings have to be any more bulky than steel frame buildings.
Have you seen any other big trends in the last 10 years that may have been influenced by September 11th in terms of architectural design?
I do think people respond more to security in the sense that lobbies aren't as accessible. There are fewer entry points so that they can be controlled. There are a lot more cameras everywhere. One of the striking things when I was at the memorial, 9/11 memorial at Ground Zero, which is a very elegant plaza with the two footprints of the towers preserved, and there are rows and rows of trees, and interspersed in those trees are these very elegant, sleek light posts, and on each post is a round security eye.
Huh.
And I find that unnerving, you know, that I'm being watched all the time. I realize why it has to be done, but it's still unnerving.
Have you found that people seek out other kinds of spaces? You said earlier how you mourn the loss of Independence Mall for yourself. Have you found yourself seeking out a different kind of place, maybe a park? And have you heard that from other people?
Well, you know, given a choice between going through a security check and not, I would go to the place where I didn't have to go through the security check just because it was easier. It'll be interesting. At this 9/11 memorial, there is a smaller park just catty corner from it where there's no security. Will people go to that one instead? Even though it's less nice, it's older, it's more worn. I think the tendency is to go to places with less security.
And that is Inga Safran. She is the architectural columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this morning.
It's my pleasure, Maiken.
Thank you, Inga. I'm Maiken Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times.